community-based organisations an opportunity to get their ideas out there and funded. And she'll tell us more about their project doing that. We've got Robert Hikiza, who joins us from Uganda. He's the director of a refugee-led organisation called Yared African Refugees for Integral Development, Yared. So Robert's going to tell us about how they work in Uganda and support their own community there in Kampala. And finally, Avila Kilmurray, who is the Director of Policy and Strategy at the Global Fund for Community Foundations. So as it says on the tin, a kind of grassroots grant maker, if you like, supporting the institutional capacity building and philanthropy at a community level. So the way we're going to structure it is these guys have got amazing things to say. We're just going to run through and then have Q&A at the end. Except Avila, unfortunately, has to run off and catch a flight. So she's going to present first, and we'll have an opportunity to spend 5-10 minutes asking her questions before she has to go. Then we'll listen to the others and save all the rest of the questions till the end. So I'll hand over to you, Avila. Do you want to come and stand?
Okay.
You're welcome to sit here if you
prefer. That's all right.
Yeah?
I stand, I'm small. I'm used to standing. People don't see me. And apologies, yes, because actually this session on the provision programme was on this morning, so I cheerfully booked my flight. So if I'm walking out, it's not any comment on the audience, on the speakers. So thank you very much for this opportunity. As Louise said, I work with the Global Fund for Community Foundations, which was set up in 2006 to give very small grants to help develop community foundations in the Global South, Eastern Europe, and across Russia, mainly. And more recently, the Global Fund is acting as a secretariat for a 5-year learning initiative by 6 major donors about community philanthropy. And that's the Ford Foundation, the Mott Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the Aga Khan Foundation, USAID, and the Inter-American Foundation, who all have had experience with community-based philanthropy, but have come together to try and learn to see where is their sort of scaling opportunities and how can they be used in different contexts. And that brings me on to why I'm here, because essentially I'm an outsider. Before I had this position, which I took up last year, I ran the Community Foundation for Northern Ireland for over 20 years, through the Troubles and through the peace process. So it actually gave me an insight into how community philanthropy can be used in different contexts. And one of the things I'm very conscious of in terms of sort of doing work with community foundations, particularly the Global South, is how complementary they are to issues of development, to issues of humanitarian relief, and indeed to issues around the disaster field. But when I do a flip side and talk to organisations that I know in those fields, in most cases they never heard them. So I reckon there was a bit of a disjuncture there. And I think the real complementarity comes on issues that I know a lot of you face in terms of exit strategies and then the sustainability of some of the work. And it was interesting just hearing the initial contribution yesterday about how long refugee camps actually, that were first of all regarded as emergency, as short term, but actually we're talking about 20 years, perhaps even more, which means that sustainability is a major issue. And similarly, in terms of the disaster field, we work very closely with the Women's Fund in Haiti, TIWA, which was established in 1998, has developed a funding base of 3,000 local donors. Got an email from them last week saying, hey, since last May, we have now got 331 new INGOs working in Kathmandu, and nobody's come near us. And yet they're the ones that have been funding rural women's groups over those years and will be continuing to fund them long after perhaps Haiti is no longer an emergency. I'm sorry, Nepal is no longer an emergency. But certainly in Haiti, where actually the experience of work with development aid and humanitarian organisations has actually brought together a group of people who've been working over the last 5 years to set up a community foundation because of the sense of disempowerment they felt. And people feeling that, local people feeling that there was an increased dependency culture and that they wanted to do something differently. And the other reason I think that's important to link the community philanthropy side of the house with INGOs working in different contexts is, going back to Mary Anderson Brown and Jean's book about Time to Listen, which came out of that collaborative development alliance, They're the things that just keep being repeated. And yet the paradigms, to quote this morning's speaker, never seem to shift. And actually, one of the things that we've seen in terms of community philanthropy is quite a lot of the new community philanthropy organisations being set up in the Global South are being set up by local people who themselves work in development agencies and got fed up and felt that something different had to be done. So what are we talking about? Basically, there was a community foundation atlas done last November, and it came up with about 1,836 community foundations type organisations around the world. A whole block of them in the North America, UK, who have been going now about 100 years, came out of a different background. They were set up as donor service organisations. But the biggest increase in the last 25 years has been the Global South and Eastern Europe, and they've come from a very different community action base, whereas basically local people say, we want to be able to plan in the long term and to have a grassroots funder that actually can act as a knowledge hub about what's going on in the local community, but it's going to be there, and we can rely on that it's going to be there. So consequently, it can do development at a pace that is actually appropriate for any sensible community development worker, if they're not tied by some funding programme that says you have to spend all this money in the next 3 years. So what we're talking about, as distinct from standard community-based organisations, or indeed local NGOs, is an organisation that comes together to mobilise resources, financial resources, but also other resources, resources in kind, knowledge resources, or whatever else, so that it can then make small grants. It is actually a grant maker. Some of them also have operational programmes, but essentially it is a grant maker to other community-based activities in a set geographical area. A lot of them go by the name of community foundations, but we also have women's funds that are geographically located, human rights funds, environmental funds, and there has been sort of talking between all those groups, because they're all doing similar things, except some are more thematically focused and others are purely geographically focused. The other important thing that they have is their independence. We don't set hard and fast definitions. Sorry, academics. However, we talk about a family characteristic that they all have. And one of the family characteristics is independent in that they're multi-stakeholder. So that's not just a company that set up a fund or a family that set up a fund, but it is that the resources come from a range of sources, which can be external, which can be corporate, which can be private, and in some cases are actually raised from the local communities themselves, like the Tiwa example in Nepal, which is 3,000 women donors. But also they're multi-stakeholder in terms of their governance, which is important. Because again, what we encourage, and what many of them do, is they might have people from different regional areas, if they're covering a fairly big regional base. They may well have people in terms of the gender balance. And for those working in divided societies, where I was myself, our board is half Catholic, half Protestant. You reflected in your structure and governance the divisions within the society, because people looked at it and then saw sort of themselves or not. And the other two family characteristics is that alongside grant making, most of them will talk about doing added value capacity building work, either themselves or putting the people that they're funding in touch with another NGO to do that work, and indeed to support networking. And lastly, which is a bit nebulous but is very important, is the building of social capital, because you're working between communities, you're working with the diversities within communities, but you're also working in many cases with donors, local donors or external donors or both, and people that are actually doing the operational work on the ground. So in terms of time, very briefly then, a bit more in terms of complementarity. First of all, there is that sense of ownership. And I think one of the things that we're constantly being reflected back from the people that we're working with is a feeling that they want a sense of respect. That issue about dependency, that what being involved in a community-based philanthropy gives them is a sense of independence, that they are actually making the decisions. But also, as I say, that it is money plus. So, for example, there's a brilliant case study from the Kenya Community Development Foundation comparing the building of wells by an INGO, which comes in with all the expertise, delivers all these wells within a set period of time, and actually taking the time to give a much smaller grant and get villages to buy in to help them to build the wells
in positions that they decide where they want them, and actually say, in that case, the maintenance and sense of ownership is much more important. The other thing that we're sort of seeing is that, a tranche of community philanthropy organisations that, as I say, are either in areas of conflict, like Ukraine, there are 23 of them across Ukraine, or indeed Sri Lanka, the northeast of India, where the Foundation for Social Transformation is able to work across the seven states there, where you have the Nogaland, and there are about three different movements, in fact, in terms of, you know, identity issues. But because it is a local community with people from those seven states on the board, they have a credibility to almost go under the skin of where the Indian government currently is, for example, trying to get rid of the Ford Foundation because it's seen as this outside body that's influencing a situation. Similarly, there's 47 community foundations across Russia, right across to Siberia, who work away really quite happily. There's problems in terms of the restrictive space and some of the legislation, but actually, because they're grounded, they can actually do things that perhaps external organisations can't do. And when you can actually marry, you know, some of the interests of the external organisations, for example, be it human rights or women's rights, whatever else, with that sort of local groundedness, then there are ways of getting things done that don't become such an issue. For my own community foundation, worked again with, you know, all sections of the community, including combatants, right through the Troubles. Because actually, people aren't just combatants, they're living next door to you. So once you actually talk then in terms of actually working in an inclusive way with communities, there are ways, by having a value base, there are ways to actually be able to sort of pick up nuances, get messages across, and actually do cross-community work that couldn't be done otherwise. So in the disaster area, for example, when we had the floods in Sarajevo in May last year, the Tuzla and Mosaic Community Foundations were, within 12 hours, once they checked out that their staff and board members were safe, were able to mobilise their networks of young volunteers to go out and start looking at community needs. Long before, I hope you know, other organisations with huge state resources came in into the situation. And then there is also the issue that was raised yesterday in discussion, the fact that because it is local and you've got local people involved, that accountability can be actually addressed up front, because people want to know where the money has gone, who's getting it, and what are they doing. The Dalia Association in Palestine, for example, where they were concerned about the lack of accountability and certainly high levels of dependency, they actually developed a system where they were working with rural villages and actually gave the rural village, the residents, the power to vote as to what community projects they wanted the money to go to. Now, we're talking about small amounts of money, tiny amounts of money. When I went and visited those villages, and, you know, those huge big placards for, as described USAID as the new Romans, for both water and roads. But actually, the villagers were talking about whatever it was, the $12,000 that they had control of actually allocating. But Dalia went further than that, and at the same time as the villagers were actually deciding the allocation of money, they voted their monitoring and accountability committee. So Granny Shai wanted to know where the last shekel had gone, because she was on that committee and she was living next door to where it was done. So, you know, the issues of accountability are also areas that are very important for a lot of community foundations. And just very briefly, because I see what originally I'm trying to watch, I think in terms of the possibilities, if we're going to looking at innovation, for me, one of the things that I would love to see is INGOs, and as I say, there is complementarity, because clearly the sort of organisations that I'm talking about, in most cases, not all, but in most cases, would have limited facility to handle the huge scale of emergency relief that might be needed immediately in situations. But whether it is possible to actually consider them in terms of long-term planning. For example, with the Haiti situation, I mean, one of the annoyances for the local people in the foundation movement there is latest evidence says that 0.6% of the billions of dollars that went to Haiti were handled by local people. Everything else, the decision-making, was external to that country, be it corporations or NGOs. So they're sort of saying, look, even if 0.0% had been sort of set aside or used in some way to build sort of endowment base, and most of these organisations do try and build up reserves, we know the situation is going to take 20, 30, 40 years. We know it's going to be intergenerational. Similarly, in situations of conflict, we don't need huge amounts of money, but if we can do it over a longer term frame, it is much more effective. I had millions of euro in Northern Ireland with a peace programme for the European Union. We played about, in 1995, give us less over a longer period and let us plan. No, had to hit the ground, spent in 3 years, or you lost it. It's just not cost-effective, basically. And that's the sort of paradigm shift that needs to happen and that community foundations can help make happen. The other innovation that I do think is sitting there in many ways waiting to happen, listening to some of your discussions and conversations at the conference here, is looking at, we talked about social cohesion in the workshop this morning. Actually, you know, when you can structure something where different communities are actually a part of the decision-making process, then you can make a difference in terms of some of your social cohesion, particularly when it's a longer-term process. Because you are picking up what the issues are on the ground. And in situations of conflict, those issues change over the length of the conflict or over different phases of the conflict. So if you can actually think, for example, of something between, say, you know, internally displaced people and settled communities where they jointly form a board, or in many cases, you know, philanthropy organisations will have subcommittees where it's made up of different groups, so that you're building in the conversation and the awareness of the sensitivities over and above the actual grant making, then it can make a big difference. Extreme case, we got away with it. In Northern Ireland, we had the European money for reintegration of all the collected prisoners. We did a grant advisory committee that was made of 5 parliamentary groups that have pleased to continue to work. And there are still meeting. And what that does, it gives you the back channel communication to actually alleviate other points of conflict that are coming up. Similarly in other societies. So I leave it there. And I'm just very conscious that Mike, was it in our first panel yesterday, said small is small. Small is small, but I always quote the Dalai Lama, try going to bed without speed.
Thanks very much, Avila. As we mentioned, the people who weren't here before, we're going to ask Avila some questions now because you have to run off. So I'll open the floor to you guys to have a few questions.
Thanks for a really inspiring talk. I'm not going to try the mosquito thing. I wonder when you go into communities that aren't used to kind of Western-style democracy, that are more used to kind of channeling through sort of village heads or elders, do you work through those channels, or do you say, no, actually, we want community involvement at all levels?
Okay.
Do you want to go ahead and answer?
We basically take our lead from the local. However, what we would tend to do is start with what the local group that is coming together says that they feel they use to get something off the ground. But then what we would do is sort of say, well, but who is not here? So if it was, you know, village elders of just one tribe, then you'd be sort of saying, hey, look, you know, that's not really going to work because we're not just about meeting one group's needs. It has to be on a broader basis. Where you take a probably more gradualist approach would be if you're sort of starting with sort of a degree of compromise, but then sort of saying, but there's a group of internally displaced people here, or there's a refugee camp. Now, you know, and in some cases, it really does vary in terms of who happens to be coming together to actually get the initiative going. In some cases, you can build in that from the beginning, or you can even actually, you know, if you've got a sort of potential donor. And what we try and do with external donors, we would argue that it should be matched funding. So say someone like Ford, sort of say to Ford, look, you know, for every pound, dollar, whatever it is raised, you offer to double it. So you're not taking control, but it does mean that you can raise issues like that as a broker. So there is a value base for inclusion, but in practical terms, you really take a weather check about how you actually do that on the ground, but with the progression route that, look, there's a group here that there's an issue with and that we really need to get involved. And the other way we do it as well is you can sometimes get away with it by, you know, rather than challenging the sort of the status element from the word go, is to say, okay, so-and-so and so-and-so, fair enough, has to be involved, but then we have a substructure of advisory committees who then sort of come up
other questions? No? I'll ask you a question if that's okay. I wondered, are the groups that you're supporting, they've already started their own financial mechanism in a philanthropic way already. So the first bit was, what added benefits do they get from working with you guys? So are they already, they're already doing some of what you're supporting them to do? So do they come to you and what do they get from it?
Okay.
I had a follow-up thing as well. But then are there groups who want to give money to things that are external from their own community problems? So are there philanthropic groups which want to, you know, maybe it's a group of companies in Uganda who want to provide to refugees in Uganda. Mm-hmm. So there's already a like power differential, and how do you allocate funding to those kind of groups?
Okay.
Sorry, that's two questions.
Okay, so the first one was in terms of, we generally work with people that are already started. We don't have a basis of almost like parachuting in, because that basically would replicate what we criticise. But what we do recognise, well, people know what they know. So we do a lot of work in just spreading the concept and then sort of see sort of who's interested. What we are finding, and then in that case we have some very small organisation development grants, like $10,000, whatever. You know, but a lot of the work is actually in convenings, where we actually bring people together on a peer learning basis. So we just had one in Kathmandu last November, where we had about 15 different countries where people came together. So the Kenyans were saying what worked. They were, and the Guangdong Community Foundation, that started in South of China, was talking about, you know, what they did to actually be able to do something in China, and the Russians were there, whatever else. And that actually has been very effective, because it's not bringing in people as artificial experts. It's sort of saying, you tell us what's worked, you know, in terms of your situation. But we also are noticing, particularly the last number of years, an increasing number coming to us, say, from a very strong community development base. For example, last week I was in Brazil, and was a really good community development organisation, working for 18 years, one of the big barrios in Rio. And they were sort of saying, look, we've got all these operational programmes, but we can't plan for the long term. You know, we're always hand to mouth and jigsaw in terms of funding. We want to set up a community foundation, and we want to use that to build the independence of the other groups, the women's groups and the youth groups that are working in this barrio. And in that case, then, we would both provide sort of some documentation, some advice, but also sort of say, right, okay, we've got nothing to teach you about community engagement. You're way ahead of a lot of them. However, you need to know about maximising and raising resources. So the best thing might be for you to visit actually a couple of the North American ones that where they're strong on that. So it's really mixing and matching in terms of the sort of what people need. And your second question, yeah, in terms of, say, a corporate that wanted to fund in a number of different countries, I mean, first of all, we would tend to act as signaller rather than necessarily handle it ourselves. If it's that they want to go to another country where there isn't a similar structure, we would talk to them about what they want to do. I mean, there has been a number of cases of corporates saying, we want to set up something. And there it would be then a matter of, well, who's there, who's doing what, you know, and just making people aware there's an opportunity there. But what we generally try and do is not lead with the money, because that distorts the process, you know. Leading more with the idea and see people then sort of coming together around the idea. What we have done in the past is where those mainly with sort of independent trusts or foundations, you know, where recently, in fact, we've won and said, we're really interested in community philanthropy and the environment, you know, and they would make available a block of money and we would say, okay, out of this large catchment of community foundations, who's interested in trialing something around, you know, a local giving in the environment? And there then, and then we would give the grants and then bring people together in that sort of learning situation.
Thank you very much. If there are no more burning questions, I'll move on to the next speaker. Great. Thank you very much. So, Gavin.
Yes. G'day, guys. I'm Gavin Ackley. I'm the director of the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre's Innovation Hub. Fortunately, my boss named it the Innovation Hub. He was unaware of the big movement towards labs, so this is not a lab. We have a lab in there. This is a a high volume service centre that assists asylum seekers around empowerment. So we have employment programs, we have education programs, community development and social enterprise. So we have businesses, and it's a large centre. So we would probably, as a whole centre, we may have about 3,000 clients at any one time. We have about 1,100 volunteers and about 60 paid staff. A few years back, I was forced to really look at the model that we were using. I don't know if you know about Australia at the moment, but a Prime Minister who's crazy. And what we would say in Australia in the old days is he's got a few kangaroos loose in the top paddock, which is so we were forced to go back because the demand out there was so high. And basically, the Australian government has got a big backlog of asylum seekers. For an Australian, I think there's 35,000 in the community, and there's no flow through, so they froze all processing of these people, so the demand got big. Had to relook at the model that we were using. I'm from a kind of engineering, electrical, plumber, electrician, and I went back and really started looking at what's this model that we all use, this agency model, and worked out that it's this model that's been around for a couple of hundred years and comes from this mission-style approach of dealing with disadvantage. We all use it, all our agencies are using it. And we're in this paradigm that we can't see out of because we've always just done it this way. So I asked a lot of questions and met with a lot of asylum seekers and sector staff, and three things came out of it is everybody who works in an agency is completely overwhelmed and feels under-resourced, and also feel that they're only touching a small percentage of the demand that's out there. That's everybody. The second thing is everyone feels that we're band-aiding things. It's just plugging gaps all the time. And third, which is the most distressing, is there's a really growing feeling that we're part of the problem. And that's, I'm just finishing a Churchill Fellowship, and there's a lot of feeling from a lot of the people I've met with, everyone that looks at the agency as maybe we're creating deeper problems than we're solving. From an engineering background, if you had a model like this one, you would rip it out and throw it out and put something else in there. It doesn't work, and the statistics show it doesn't work. So what does work? Went back and looked at how engineers create scale, and looked at another sector completely, and built this concept called symbiotic innovation. Now, symbiotic innovation, people ask, isn't it just collaboration? Aren't you just collaborating with the service user community? Collaboration's got this notion that we can choose to collaborate, but we can't. The reality is, when we really look at this, we can't meet our aims without including the service user community. It is insane to think that a removed third-party organism like the agency can implant itself into a community just because I want a funding contract and I'm going to solve the problems of these people. If you just think about that, that doesn't make sense. And what we're doing worse than that is we're weakening the structures of community. So the more responsibility I take away from an asylum seeker who's living with his family, while I think I'm doing good, I'm actually taking that responsibility away from them. There's very few things in Australia anyway that an agency doesn't have. Childcare, aged care, employment. We farm everything out to the professional. And for us it's okay because we can buy our way out of it. Like if we've got a problem, we can just pay someone. But when it comes to disadvantaged communities, they can't buy their way out of it. And because we're weakening the structure of them helping each other, and we've done this with our Indigenous people as well, horrific stuff, these people are left at trying to get aid from an agency that's completely overwhelmed, so they can't get in, and there's no one in the community to help them anymore. And that's just what we set up. So the idea of symbiotic innovation was basically to look at what the agency does well. We do networking well. We do things like raising funds. We have an organisational memory. We do that well. What we're looking at is the service agency becoming the training ground for asylum seekers. So the way of doing this, we've integrated our centre with asylum seekers. So they work along next to us, running employment programs, running social entrepreneur programs. Why they're doing this is, if I teach you to find a job, for instance, you learn how to find a job, and that's fine. But if I could actually teach you how to teach someone how to find a job, when your daughter, you have one, gets to a certain age and leaves school and faces the same problems that most refugee kids do, which is unemployment, you're going to be able to pass that information on to how to find a job. Same with English. Asylum seekers already teach each other how to speak English. What we're doing is having a part of our EAL training, and so they're learning how to actually teach people how to learn English. Now, the concept when I brought it into my staff was quite shocking for them at the beginning. I've learned a lot about change management over the last year. Everyone agrees with this. Everyone's like, yes, the service user community, they should be giving each other this help. You know, we are getting in the way of things like this. But what it requires is for us to have a power equal relationship with the asylum seeker. And that's really complicated because we've all been trained as social workers and welfare workers about boundaries, about I'm the advocate, you're the client. And to say to a whole lot of professionals who are working in high volume, you know, large caseloads, forget all that now. The new expert is coming into the room and they're going to be working on that alongside you and having the same say as you are is a really tough thing for people to go through. And Louise is part of the research into this project of implementing this in Melbourne. And there's two things. One is the model of symbiotic innovation, which I've been more and more convinced this is the way forward. It's the missing link for agencies. The other part is, is it possible for the agency to change itself? I mean, I hear all discussions during this conference of people sitting around trying to decide what's good for a community. Maybe they, you know, maybe they need this or maybe they need that. And I went through this the same thing once where I was sitting there going, English for work. It never works for us. We keep making this program and it never works. We change things around. And we're sitting there one day going, okay, maybe we should run it on Tuesday and we should do it in the afternoon. And I was sitting around looking at it, at the group, and it was us again sitting in this room trying to decide for asylum seekers what would work for them. And I nearly went crazy at that point. I was like, we can't get the answer because we've got the same people in the room all the time. The other part of it is, is this thing about can the agency change? And I think a part of this research is going to be very interesting because I know hearing from the UN and all this, UNHCR, that they do want to embrace this user-led and participation. They just don't know how to do it. And I don't think anyone in this room is going to be saying, no, we should be always sitting up here and then down there. But it's what the real learning is the process that the agency itself is going through now to actually do itself a bit out of a job. I'll just... The way that particularly we're trialling this in Melbourne is for the program managers, we're not going to telling them particularly what they have to start doing. But we're saying that there's eight principles and we're using emergence theory to generate, facilitate innovation. So we're saying to each of the managers, and there's explanations if you read the paper about what these different things are, that you need to have this in your program. Can you push just the next one? And we've broken it down to a four-step implementation process for the managers. So a shared purpose is, for instance, if you've got a program, what is the impact you're trying to create with that program? If you read people's vision statements, we construct this final impact for all our agencies. We would like to see asylum seekers be independent. And then we go down to the asylum seekers after we've even put outcomes and then ask them what they think of what we've done. We need to be beginning with what impact do they want to see? What is the end result they actually want? Maybe they don't want to be independent. Maybe they want to be part of community. Integration, again, integrating us in this power-neutral relationship. The way that we do this is a really great narrative approach to things, where they do this a lot in some labs, where they say, okay, we can't get two groups to connect together. One of them was like a banker, the other one was the startup group. So what they did is they set up these opportunities that the banker could run a course in how to grow tomatoes, and or whatever they're good at, and the startup people could run a course in woodworking. What that does, though, is it changes the relationship between the narrative of I'm a startup and you're a banker to actually you're not just that, you're a potato, you know, tomato grower, and I'm different. So what we've done in this was we allowed the asylum seekers to generate some solutions within the organisation. One of them was that you need to be speaking Farsi. So when people come into your centre who can't speak any English, what would really make them feel part of your centre would be if you could speak some basic Farsi. So an asylum seeker who was a Farsi teacher in Iran actually started running a session on Farsi. And it was amazing that we had an asylum seeker woman who was a very vulnerable person at some point in her life, standing up in front of a class with all the caseworkers who were typically on the other way, and the caseworkers sitting there being in a powerless position. But it really changed the dynamic and her feeling of her part of being part of the centre. Because all of a sudden, there's another story to her life rather than just being a victim of asylum seeker. I could go through the cycle of innovation, but particularly about reinforcement. When people come up with science, has come up with these ideas like the Farsi thing, what we generally do is, great, we'll put that to the side, you run it, and we'll get back to our own business. When we're talking about reinforcements, actually, we need to invest in this. We actually need to say the stuff that we're doing is not as important as the stuff they're doing. Because if we can create solutions that live in the community, that are driven by the community, our capacity to help people, assist people, is infinite. It's, if you look at it just as a model, you're like, okay, if people are coming in who are disadvantaged and they're actually part of feeding back in the loop and creating advantage, we have a system that can scale very quickly, and that's how they do it in engineering. But what it's going to take is for these poor, nice staff in Melbourne to go through this process, and hopefully by the end of the research, we can really understand how we can have a bit more dignity to our approach, and how can we really change this paradigm we are in. And I was at Latino Health Access, which is in Santa Ana, in the States, which is completely user-led, fantastic program, America Bracco, if you can watch the TEDs, it's amazing. And the person was dropping me off, and she's a psychologist. And she said, yeah, I've learned something. She said, paradigm shifts suck, they hurt. But I've realised that all my qualifications that I got as a psychologist mean nothing. The expert is the person in front of me. They're the person I should be listening to. I shouldn't be listening to a white man who wrote a book, you know, 5 years ago. And I think we have to go through a bit of pain to innovate. We can't just innovate around the edges with a new product or a new website. We are the problem. We need to change. Thank you.
Thanks, Gillian. That was amazing. We'll move on and then we'll do questions at the end. So,
good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for watching. My name is Europa Chakiza. I don't know if you can see there. And I am the director and co-founder for YARIS. YARIS stands for Young African Refugees for Integral Development. And it is based in Kampala, Uganda. Yeah, so in my presentation here, I won't just try to tell you about my project and how we started and where we are now, the challenges that we faced, and how we managed to keep this organization from the community up to now. It started in 2007, and that is the time that I found myself in Kampala, Uganda, after fleeing my country in Congo because of the war. And as you know, Kampala have been receiving a number of refugees for years now. And we, just after crossing the border, we decided to move up to Kampala. And as you know, in Uganda, and I think in other places, the refugees who stay in the settlement and others, because of some reason, they don't want to go there, they stay in urban area. And this depends sometimes on the background. Some people come and they have the rural background and others, you know. They have to make a choice, and especially today, as it's officially allowed to people to choose where to stay. So I decided to go to Kampala. So in Kampala, I found too many other refugees there, and the community, and you know, the largest population in Uganda here today, and in that time, Congolese. And so we have a very big community there. One of the things that when a refugee comes, when you come to Uganda, one of the things, if you decide to stay in urban setting, it's very clear, they tell you, if you have, you need any support, or you don't have anywhere to stay, you don't have food, and you have to go to the settlement. If you want to stay in the Kampala, then you have to be able to cater for yourself. And you know, because of the reason I've given you, some of the people don't have anything to look, anything that they can do to support themselves in Kampala, but just say, me, I will stay in Kampala because, you know, I have a business, and at the office of Prime Minister, you don't have any mechanism on ground to verify exactly what the refugee has said is true. Because you can say, I have a business, who knows if the business exists or not, you know? So, and they give you permission to stay in Kampala. So in Kampala, so when I reached there, so, you know, my habit, I don't want to sit down. Every time that I move to a new place, I need to meet people and to move around and to look at other people so that you can chat. And so in that time, my observation, I realized that many people are suffering, especially the young people. And you know, you find yourself in a new environment, you don't have access to education, you don't have access, you know, all the challenges. There was a very big gap in terms of service provided to the refugees in the urban area. That's why we came up together with my two colleagues who are no longer, unfortunately, in Kampala, they went to a different part of the world. So we decided to do something, to say, okay, we know that we don't have resources, we don't have... I remember the time one of the colleagues had just finished rural development studies, I think, in Congo, and the other one was just... came to Uganda after finishing secondary school. So he said, we need to do something. And you know, that was actually the difficult part. Yes, we need to do something. That's where we start from. And how are we going to do this? Because, you know, look at people. They don't have food. People don't have access to education. Are we going to be able to provide these services to the people? They said, no. Yeah, let's just look for a way that we can come together and see how we can try to look for, together we can try to look for some solution affecting the problem that we're having. That's when, as we're trying to think of this, and as our targets were mostly oriented to the young people, we came up with the idea of starting a football team. Like, let's start a football. Because even the ball, I remember we did have a ball. Well, I don't even remember how we got the ball. I think someone gave us the ball. And this place that we see here, that was the first place that the first place where we started our meetings, this playground here, because it was the only place available, public place where people could come, and you know, Ugandans and refugees. And so we started playing football, and that was done in the morning and in the evening. So as you know, the idea was to do what? Not really to have a football team, but for us, we say, okay, you know, young people, they like playing, especially when it comes to football. It's very popular for young people, you know. And directly when we decide to start, we say, what do you think? Why can't you start a football team for refugees here in Kampala? And people say, yes, it's a good idea. So the first day, I remember, we came at some, when we started playing, and it was very difficult to choose who's going to play, who's not going to play. Because many people came, and what we were doing, just you come and play for 10 minutes, you go and the other one play, because you know we couldn't go beyond 11 players are allowed to move in football. So that's where we started. And we kept on coming, playing football in the morning and evening, but all the time after playing football, we could get some time, we sit down and start discussing about some of the problems that are affecting our life. That was the genesis. That is how we started this organization. And from that time, as we're trying to look at the problem, the major problems that people are facing, you know, we realized that the problem of language was the big problem, because the majority of the people that come from the French-speaking countries, and you know they cannot, there's nothing they can do in Uganda if you don't know the language, English, or one of the local languages. So that's when after identifying that was a very big problem, we came up with an idea, so we need to do something, at least why can't we start an English class? So of course, the problem was to have also someone is going to teach. We were lucky. In the community, we had some people who came to Uganda 5 years before, 2 years, and who had a chance to learn a little bit of English. So we got those people volunteered the community. Said, yeah, I can do this. And we got someone to teach. The next problem was, now where are we going to do it? Is it here at the field, or we need to get a place? Then, as you know, in Uganda, we have in Kampala, we have a lot of Congolese churches around here, and actually, this place where we started, that's the most concentrated area for refugees in Kampala, in Makindye Division. So we started moving. A friend came up with the idea, we have different churches here. Maybe we can try to look around. Maybe they can allow us to use the church hall, because they don't use it all the time. Of course, as you know, not everyone could just say, oh, yeah, this is the place. So we started moving, then we got a pastor, also from Congo. He said, yeah, you guys, that's a good idea. We have this place here, and we only use it on Sunday, and sometimes one or two times during the week, weekday. So you can come and use this place. And this is exactly the place. As you can see, we have rooms here, and, you know, that's where we started teaching English. Many people came as well. We couldn't even manage them because the number was just very big. At that time, the only place where refugees could learn English, it was at GRS in Kampala, and that they were getting new people only once a year. And as you know, because of the conflict in Congo, refugees were crossing all the time. So if you come for instance, like in February, you need to wait up to the next year so that you can get that opportunity to learn English. So that colleague of us who accepted to volunteer, start teaching, was trained at GRS. So this is how we started. So we decided to start this program, and every day people come. And we started by one class, and then two classes, and then three classes. And that was actually the first level, second level, and third level. But then, even with this one, there was a problem, because people, we were very excited. We say, wow, at least we are doing something. But now another question came. Because when we finished with the first group, the other question was, what's next? Well, what's next? Now we can speak English. Are you going to use to get food? Are you going to use the English to get money? You know, that was also another challenge. So we didn't get tired of thinking. So we this time, of course, as we know, we're trying to build that community organization. Some of the people started getting interested in what we're doing. What we are doing is well. What we are doing is well. So we got, of course, some of the people who like come and support us, some books, and stuff. So then, after this, to respond to the question, we move to another program. That's the computer. This time here, all the time that we started, we did not have any office. And I remember this was our first office, and this office is the one we're still using today. We were just lucky. because that time we had honourable here, honourable Jackie is now a member of parliament in Kampala. She had an organisation, very big office. By that time, she was not really very interested in this organisation, NGOs, as she was campaigning for being an MP. So we met in one of the Pan-African meeting, and she said, yeah, that's a good idea. I have an office. Actually, sometimes the office can be closed for 1 month. If you guys you want to use it, you are welcome. So she opened the door and they said it was a very big office. We had very nice chairs. We couldn't imagine that. This is the place that is given to us. She was really very generous. And we started using the place. And that place now became like, you know, a place where all the refugees would come every day, noisy, you know, or the young people, you know. So we as we trying to move around, get support, we got some few computers, so we decided to respond to those questions, what's next, to start the computer training. And we got also internet, so people could come, and after the English, those who are completing English, they could come and join, you know, also get an opportunity to access internet. And today, we have made it a little bit big because we are partnering with another organization, it's called Save the Projects. There is one of them is here, also presented yesterday about their work in Kenya and in Uganda. So, Eddie managed to secure some funding from here, UK. So we opened a hub. Now, a hub, actually, we decided to break one of the offices that was there to make it a little bit big. And the hub where now we had 15 machine, computer, and internet. So we made it very big. So on top of the computer training, we decided to come up with another program teaching social media, and also today it's a place where people come and meet, access internet for free. So after this one, as you know, we decided to start also this other program. As you know, we had our English classes, many people could come, and especially the women. Of course, I didn't talk about other training that we have, because it's not only English that we will be training, but also the literacy program where we teach people how to write and to read. We have the business skills that we give to people. You know. So we participated that was in 2013, in global giving campaign, and we managed to raise, I think, it was something like $1,500. And I said, you know, when you look in Uganda, most of the people, the breadwinners of the household, they are women, and these are the people who move around every time to look for food for their family. So he said, maybe if you open a special place for the women, that would be a good idea. So that's when we started our women empowerment projects, and where we have some sewing machines, so they come, they train them, and after we encourage them to go back and start their own business. But in 1 week, we have also one free day, because also accessing a sewing machine for those who are competing is not easy. They go back, and sometimes, you know, they cannot put in practice the skill, because actually that's one of the challenges. So we decided to have one free day that those who don't have access to sewing machine can come from morning up to evening. They use the sewing machine that we have there. They can do their work and so on. So, So how we manage this? As you know, and you've heard what I said at the beginning, how did we manage to keep this organization and to achieve some of after there? The first thing was the close collaboration of the community. I think this was the most important thing. Without the community, we couldn't have done this. So, because we could come together, we think together, we decide what to do together, and that was something very important. That was actually giving us even, you know, that courage to continue and think. So, secondly, there is a space for discussion. You know, every time that we could meet, it was open. Everyone, if you have any good idea, bring the idea here. Because It was not like for us to start the organization and say, this is what we are going to do. So we had this space where people created a space where people could come and share ideas and we decide together, as they say. So, next, please. So also, the other thing that helped us, it was because we used the local resources. I can't tell you the teacher that the teacher that we had came from the organization, and I can't count the number of times that when you could need a box of chalk, it was people's money. Oh, I have 1,000 Ugandan shillings. Maybe we can use this. So we the local resources was really very important for us, because everyone, when we create a space where everyone can come and contribute, feel like everyone owes what we do. It's you know, it helps the project to continue. Yeah. Then, of course, together with this determination of the members, because everyone was determined and said, we have to do this. And every time that we achieve something, people were very excited. So next, as you know, there is no anything that can be done without challenge. We faced many, many challenges, as you know. Doing all what we're doing without any enough resources to do this, we had really lack of capacity to implement some of the innovation. I remember sometimes we have many ideas, but because of lack of capacity, so this one you cannot do. Let's move to another one. This one you cannot do. Let's move to another. After when we get the one that we feel like we can do. So there was a lack of capacity. And here, I don't only talk about the financial stuff, resources, we had also a lack of the people, human resources, people who could really do the work that we wanted, exactly, because as we know, like all the people teaching and myself, no one has experience in what we're doing. Yeah. So the second one was negative attitude of big organizations. As a refugee organization, we face too many problems. Sometimes we could move around here looking for some organization that can support. You go, you introduce yourself, I'm Robert. You are from where? I'm from Congo. What are you doing in Uganda? I'm a refugee. We have refugees here. Yeah. And surprisingly, even the high authorities, big people, sometimes it was. That means we are here, all this dumb and people don't know that we are here. Sometimes we could ask ourselves this question. So negative attitudes, we go, we say, can you pass now? Because we have this program and maybe we can work together. No one to pass now. And that was also a big challenge that we faced. Negative attitude of big organization. Yeah. The next one is the challenge of integration. As you know, we started the organization, but apart from the good idea that we could come with, we were also facing the same challenges as others. We shared the same problem. The problem of integration was for all of us, not only for the people that we're trying to assist. Now, the lessons that I learned from this, I can say, the importance of community knowledge. From this, I came to learn that we have too many good ideas in the community. Because when you look at most of the things that we're doing, the idea were coming from the community. Someone will come and say, "What to do this? How?" So the community knowledge is really very, very important, especially when you want to do something in a town there. So the second thing was the financial resource is not the only one. Sometimes people just say, we cannot do this because we don't have money. We cannot do this because we need thousands of dollars, and especially when you try to, because sometimes we want to do this, what the budget fights, where are we going to get this? And you see many people just say, oh, no, this one we cannot do because we don't have money. So financial resource is not the only one. So when you have an idea, there are many ways that you can find to at least to start to do something, you know. So the next one is they never fear to try an idea. As I said, we got too many ideas from the people, from the community, as every time that we could make. And we did not try. Even the one that we think that maybe this one, maybe it doesn't need money, but we need, like, this person, this kind of person, we say, let's try. Let's try. If it doesn't work, then we leave it. Let's try. If it doesn't work up to when we, you know, of course, by trying, you learn more. And of course, if you try, then you can get an idea. Maybe someone can come and say, oh, I can do this.